University of Montana President Royce Engstrom has picked the site for the new Missoula College. Good evening. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has more Montana reaction to the federal government shutdown. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock takes us on a tour of a new exhibit of folk art at the Missoula Art Museum. It's official. East Broadway will be the site of the new Missoula College. University of Montana President Royce Engstrom made the announcement today. Engstrom says putting the new college there makes a, quote, bold statement.
I think that by putting an attractive building on the East Broadway site sends a very strong message about the presence of the University of Montana in our community, first of all, and the importance of two-year education to Missoula and to the surrounding community. This is a chance for us to really showcase in a very attractive way the importance of educational opportunities for our two-year students.
Engstrom says the East Broadway location has infrastructure in place that the alternative South Campus location doesn't yet have, like parking space. And he says locating the college near downtown fosters more ties to the Missoula business community. Opponents of locating the new college on the South Campus threatened to sue if that site was picked. Their attorney, Quentin Rhodes, says they're very pleased with the East Broadway selection.
It's gratifying to see that the university listened to and worked with its neighbors and, President Engstrom in particular, to carefully consider and then reconsider what looked like a decision that had been made, for example, when they were at the legislature looking for the funding. And then after having, some questions pointed out, and they did listen and obviously listened carefully.
President Engstrom says the threat of a lawsuit was not a factor in his decision, and he says UM still plans to someday expand to the South Campus.
The South Campus master plan remains in place, and as I have said all along, the growth of this university over the next 50 to 100 years will depend on making available the South Campus in various ways. And so this decision about the Missoula College by no means takes the South Campus off the table for future development.
The university had hoped to break ground for the new Missoula College next year. Engstrom wouldn't say when he expects to break ground at the East Broadway site, but says they will move as quickly as they can.
There are many steps along the way, including architectural design. We still have environmental assessment things to do and so on. So the building of any major facility is a pretty complex process that will play out over many months. So I'm not going to give you a start date right now because that depends on how quickly all of these processes can play out. But I will tell you that we will move just as fast as we possibly can at this point, now that the decision is made.
The legislature appropriated $29 million for the new college, and UM must raise a $3 million match.
And in other news from around the state, the shutdown of major pieces of the federal government is stretching into its second day. President Obama has called Democratic and Republican congressional leaders to the White House for a meeting to try to resolve the standoff. Meanwhile, House Republicans have rejected an effort by Democrats to force a quick end to the shutdown. By a 227 to 197 vote, the House opposed the Democrats' legislation to immediately reopen the government without clamping any restrictions of President Obama's health care law. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce took to the streets of Helena today to hear what some everyday Montanans think of the shutdown and who's to blame.
Tigan Oberst. I work for an outdoor retail store, the Base Camp.
Do you have strong opinions about the government shutdown?
It's purely theater, posturing.
Do you see one side or the other being predominantly to blame?
Yeah, although it's hard not to be too partisan about it. It's quite clearly obstructionism from Congress, particularly the right-wing Tea Party backside.
Jim Blake, I work for the cable company. The Republicans just should give it up, I mean, they took it to the Supreme Court. They fought every which way they knew how to take it down. People do need health care, whether Obamacare is the answer or not. That's yet to be seen, but, they ought to at least give it a shot and let it go and stop just trying to make one party look worse than the other by doing absolutely nothing.
It's all a pushover by the Democrats to try and get something in place so that it's undoable. Chris Plummer. I'm actually an independent contractor. I'm happy the Republicans are standing up for what we really need to do. I mean, I'm not a Republican, but I know that the Republicans are definitely standing in the way, and it's pissing Obama off, which is awesome.
Donna Waite.
Bob Waite.
And where is it you two are from?
St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada, which is very close to Niagara Falls.
Why don't you talk about what is it that you folks came here to do? What is it that you're in Montana to do?
Well, we flew into Calgary, and we're going to have a rented car. Our intent was to drive down the eastern range of mountains, through Yellowstone, down through the Grand Canyon.
Your idea to stop by these national parks along the way?
Yes, that was a huge part of our trip.
Well, we are very frustrated because we have a limited time to see these things, and now we think, what are we going to do now? I mean, we have to vary our trip.
What are you going to do?
We
longer lunches.
Well, definitely with Obama. In Canada, we have national health, and we like it. And we don't understand why you don't.
My first name is Sandy. The last name is Cottle. I am a customer service rep for Xerox.
Do you consider yourself lining up with one political party or the other?
Oh, yeah, Democrat.
Is protecting Obamacare important enough to keep the government shut down, or should negotiations on it take place?
Oh, I think negotiations should take place. Absolutely. I think somebody's going to have to give.
My name's Bill Bonney. I'm a real estate broker.
Align yourself with one political party or the other?
Yes, I'm conservative.
First, do you have strong opinions about the shutdown?
Yes, I believe it's a good deal.
A good deal?
Yes, I do.
In what sense?
In the sense that the government has gone, things have just gone out of control. Taxes are too high. Jobs are lost. The economy's not what everybody's saying it is. Maybe this will help get the government spending under control.
Both sides have dug in their heels, so to speak. How do you see it shaking out?
They'll get it resolved. They always do. They're just a bunch of little kids there.
Now, a clarification on a story we brought you yesterday. In telling you about the partial government shutdown, we told you Republicans want to remove what they say is an exemption given to members of Congress and their staff that they say would allow them to get free health insurance on the Obamacare online marketplace. To clarify, multiple news organizations, including NPR, are reporting that's not true, that members of Congress and their staff will need to buy insurance from Obamacare, but their employer, in this case the government, will contribute toward those plans. This is similar to the employer contributions to health insurance plans seen in the private sector.
American Indian tribes have more than access to national parks on the line with the government shutdown, as federal funding has been cut off for crucial services, including foster care payments, nutrition programs, and financial assistance for the needy. Some tribes say they'll try to fill the gap themselves, risking deficits to cushion communities with chronic high unemployment and poverty against effects of the budget battle in Washington, D.C. But basic services, heavily subsidized by federal payments, are taking a direct hit. Crow Chairman Darren Old Coyote says the southeastern Montana reservation is suspending bus service to remote communities and furloughing employees from a major irrigation project. The Bureau of Indian Affairs says essential activities such as law enforcement, firefighting, and some social services will continue.
The Montana Farm Bureau estimates it would take a couple of weeks before the state's ag industry would feel serious impacts from the government shutdown, but the Bureau's Vice President for Governmental Affairs, John Youngberg, says what the industry is really worried about is the federal farm bill, which expired yesterday. The farm bill is the main agriculture and food policy legislation of the federal government. Youngberg says the uncertainty surrounding certain crop programs right now without a farm bill is distressing for farmers.
You have farmers and ranchers making long-term decisions on planting, long-term decisions on investment, long-term decisions on cropping, and they don't have any answers.
Fighting over the farm bill this year has focused largely over cuts to SNAP, commonly known as the food stamp program. Republicans want to cut $4 billion annually from SNAP over the next decade. Democrats say that money is still needed for those still recovering from the Great Recession. Both the House and the Senate have passed versions of the farm bill. Montana's Congressman, Republican Steve Daines, says the bills are waiting to be debated by a conference committee. Daines says he hopes the process moves along.
I'm putting a lot of pressure, as are many members who represent states that have ag businesses, leadership to get this done as quickly as possible.
Democratic Senator Max Baucus will sit on the Farm Bill Conference Committee when it does convene. This marks the second year in a row Congress has let the Farm Bill expire.
A Kalispell man and political newcomer says he's going to run for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Max Baucus. David Leeser told the Daily Inner Lake newspaper he is going to run for the Republican nomination in 2014. The air traffic manager at Glacier Park International Airport says he believes in the principles of Tea Party conservatives. He moved to Montana in 2003. State Representative Champ Edmonds of Missoula has already announced a campaign for the seat. Many expect U.S. Representative Steve Daines will enter the Senate race, where he would be considered a front runner. On the Democratic side, political newcomer Dirk Adams of Wausau has said he is running, although higher profile candidates are also expected. Baucus announced his retirement earlier this year.
A 57-year-old man from Spokane has died in a forklift crash on a U.S. Forest Service road south of Plains. The Montana Highway Patrol says the man was operating a grade L material handler on downhill grade yesterday afternoon when the forklift veered off the right side of the road and rolled down a steep hill. The man was thrown from the equipment and died at the scene. His name has not been released.
The Office of the State Public Defender says it is overloaded with cases in the Helena area and can't take any more. The chief public defender is asking a Helena judge to stop assigning them new cases. A hearing originally scheduled today on the request is being postponed after prosecutors filed their own opinions on the request. The public defender's office said staff attorneys have too many cases and are in danger of not meeting ethical obligations to properly represent clients. It said that more than 3,000 cases were assigned in 2012 to its 10 attorneys in a region that covers Lewis and Clark, Jefferson, and Broadwater counties. Lawmakers have been warned that state would have to pick up the cost if new cases are assigned to private attorneys.
A new exhibit at the Missoula Art Museum showcases folk art from around the country. The exhibit is titled Strange and Wonderful, and the pieces are from the private collection of Willem and Diane Vokers. Folk art scholar Tom Patterson gave news director Sally Mock a tour of the drawings, paintings, and sculptures in the exhibit.
Well, first of all, Tom, I think we need to talk about what folk art is. And one person I heard describe it as art of the common people. Do you think that's a pretty good description?
That is literally what it means, because it's folk. But I think there are other people that have other names for this work. Some people call it outsider art because the artists are not part of the academic art system. Some people call it self-taught art because the artists are, in fact, self-taught. There are other terms like grassroots art, idiosyncratic art, but I'm not that interested in what you call it. I'm more interested in the work.
I also heard it described as art unhindered by art history.
That's right, because most of these people have obviously no training in art history. That's not to say that they haven't looked at other art. There's a copy of the Mona Lisa in the show, so a little bit of, you know, sort of popular awareness of art history, and to the extent that, you know, any of these artists have picked up on that. But otherwise, yeah, you know, they're not educated in the arts. They're certainly very competent and educated in other areas of their lives in most cases.
In this case, for example, this exhibit was more or less collected by a couple, and they discovered many of these artists on their own. Is that a common way for folk artists to get recognition, is they really end up with some sort of patron, as it were?
Yes. Willem and Diane Vokers have been collecting this work since the 1970s, and there was not at that time a lot of widespread interest. So many of these artists were still undiscovered, and I think in most cases Willem found them by driving. You know, he just drove. A lot of these people create environments in their yards. So with a number of them, Willem happened to drive by their house and saw something in the yard that caught his eye, and so he stopped and met the people who lived there, photographed, and you know, found out that they had more things. So
part of folk art in America, anyway, comes from an African-American tradition of so-called yard shows.
That's an African-American tradition, but it's also... it's not exclusively African-American. The African-American yard shows have certain characteristics that can often be connected with African tradition. But, you know, the impulse to decorate is universal. And so in some cases, I think some of the Caucasian artists might have been inspired by black yard shows. But in most cases, I think it's been a pretty individual decision. A lot of these people are retired or maybe they've been disabled. And so suddenly they find themselves after a lifetime of working hard at a trade with time on their hands. And so they take up a creative pastime or they start decorating their yard and one thing leads to another and it suddenly becomes, you know, sort of takes over their lives.
One of those African-American artists is Mary Tillman Smith, and I think she has a piece in this exhibit. Yeah, let's look at those, okay?
Okay. Yeah. Oh, we have one right here. Mary Smith was an African-American artist who lived in Hazelhurst, Mississippi, and she her house and yard were right on a major highway. I think it's Highway 51, the famous Highway of the Blues songs. She did huge paintings on roofing tin and scrap pieces of plywood, and she put them up all over her yard. And this is typical of one of her yard paintings, and it's a quadruped. We can tell that from looking at it. It's kind of hard to tell from looking at the image whether it might be a dog or a cow or a cat, but it has text on it, as all of her work does, and you can tell by the text reads, "Hog meat good, I want some now, ha ha." So it's a pig, obviously, although it's a kind of an unusual looking pig. This is a fairly compact piece. She had much larger pieces than these, and you could see them from a great distance. So it was quite, there was quite a lot of impact to her yard show, and a lot of people noticed it. And I think Willem Volkers was one of the very first people to, as far as I know, he was the first person to collect her work. I have yet to find anyone else who was onto her before he was, and she's since become very well-known artist.
And this, of course, expresses her personal affinity for pork, I guess.
Exactly, and that's, you know, it's just whatever was on her mind at a particular time. Obviously, she probably made this in just a few minutes. She didn't labor on her painting. She just got the message across and put the thing out there and then went on and did the next thing. So she didn't have time to waste.
Another artist in the exhibit that we're looking at here is Howard Finster, and he was a Southern preacher.
Howard Finster was a circuit-riding Baptist preacher in North Georgia, and he's probably the best known artists in the exhibition. He started creating a paradise garden, he called it, in his backyard. He had a swampy backyard that was just, you know, kind of wasteland, and people had been using it for a dump before he bought it. And he cleared out the whole yard. He channeled the water into streams, and then he created a number of sculptures and small architectural structures in the garden, and then he started collecting all sorts of objects to display there. And he said he was collecting the inventions of mankind, and he wanted to get one of everything in the world. That was his goal. And at some point in 1976, he had a sideline business as a bicycle repairman, and he was working on a kid's bike, and he was patching part of it, and he had a paint smudge on his fingertip, and he said that he looked at his fingertip and suddenly a human face appeared to him on his fingertip in that paint smudge, and he said, "A warm feeling come over my body, and a voice spoke to me. It said, 'Paint sacred art.'" And he said, "You know, I can't paint art. I'm not a painter. I'm not an artist." And the voice was very insistent. So he said he took out a dollar bill from his wallet, tacked it up on the wall, and drew George Washington's portrait off of the dollar bill, and then painted it, and that became his first painting. And that set him off on this incredible career of painting thousands and thousands and thousands of artworks. I mean, I think there were, and he numbered every one of them. So toward the end of his life, he had, you know, it was definitely five figures. You know, it's like 40,000 pieces or more. And this piece here is called The Devil's Vice, and it's a very typical Howard Finster painting. It's a cutout image of a of a like a carpenter's vise or a woodworker's vise, V-I-S-E, that you would, you know, clamp something into and twist the handle. But he's playing with the word vice and vice as in, you know, the seven deadly sins, or vice as a sinful action or evil action. And he's got a figure trapped in the vice here. And then the thing is covered with color and text. And some of it is probably biblical verses. It's usually sort of a biblical inspiration. But he would just kind of free associate. He's almost like a form of automatic writing that he would do. It's a cutout. It's on a piece of plywood so that the shape of the vise and the little figure is cut out. And he did a lot of these pieces. And there are several other pieces of Finster's in the collection. He became very well known when he did record album covers for Talking Heads and REM, and suddenly he became an international phenomenon. And he was on the Johnny Carson show, and mm-hmm. so he became very, very popular.
All from that George Washington dollar bill painting.
Starting off from that, yeah. And another sculptor whose work really appeals to me a lot is Mark Negus, and he is a miniaturist. Let's walk over here and look at these small carvings that he's done. They're incredibly intricate. This is one of the artists that actually contacted Willem and Diane. I think he had read an article in a newspaper about their collection, and he noticed that they collected work by self-taught artists, and he was one of those. So he sent them, as one of these pieces, he sent them in the mail. You know, that sparked their interest, so they got back in touch with him, and then they started collecting a lot of the pieces. All of these pieces would fit in the palm of your hand. They are figure carvings, but they're also semi-functional. One is a spoon. That one is called a proper pauper's pea spoon, and the actual figure of the pauper is the handle of the spoon. And I guess you could actually use that. It's a pretty small spoon, but
and they're made out of different materials.
That's right. Some of they're carved wood, and they are some of them. This is a little bent metal piece. He's bent this little metal band. It's like a piece of copper, maybe it's two pieces of copper, to create a little silhouette of a winged rabbit. And he's got a little text drawing here that says, place next to ears and play wings as if kalimba. A kalimba is an African percussion instrument that you play with your thumbs. It's like sometimes called a thumb piano. So if you look carefully at the wings, they're cut into little strips like the individual pieces of metal on a kalimba. So apparently, I can't do that because it's under glass, but apparently
it makes you want to play it, though, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And he titled the piece Welsh Rarebit, with a very odd spelling. These are just terrific pieces, though. I never met Mark Negus, but I never knew his work before I saw the collection. But I'm fascinated by this artist, and I really want to see more of his work.
I think what strikes me just looking over all at the exhibit is how eclectic it is and how intriguing each piece is. I mean, there's nothing here that's similar to anything else in
the
exhibit.
Right. That's right. With these artists, they're all individuals expressing their individual creativity. And, you know, and it's one of the, if you want to say there's an advantage to being ignorant of art history, it's one of the, you know, it's one of the advantages for these people anyway, in that, you know, they're really coming at the work from a very personal place. And a lot of times it's eccentric, it's idiosyncratic, but, you know, that's like a huge part of its charm, I think. And it's very American in that sense.
Well, I have been speaking with Tom Patterson. He's a curator and a folk art expert. And Mr. Patterson, thank you so much for giving me a personal tour. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
Folk art scholar Tom Patterson will give a free public lecture tonight at 6:30 at the Missoula Art Museum. The American Folk Art exhibit will be on display at the museum through December 22nd.
And now for tonight's weather forecast. There is a winter weather advisory in effect from midnight tonight to 6 a.m. Friday across most of our listening area. For west of the Continental Divide, tonight will be mostly cloudy with scattered snow showers and isolated rain showers and lows in the upper 20s to mid-30s. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers and snow showers with highs in the 40s. For central Montana, tonight look for increasing clouds with a chance of snow and lows in the lower 40s. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow showers throughout the day and a chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs will be around 40 to 50 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain showers and snow. Lows will be around the lower 30s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow. Highs will be around the 30 to 40 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. Last month, I talked about preventing falls, which are the number one reason why older adults lose their independence. Tonight, I want to continue by focusing on the way future homes can be built in order to reduce the chances of falls and allow a person to age in place, even with physical disabilities. This concept is referred to as visitability. The word visitability means that a friend or family member with a physical disability can easily visit you in your home. Let me describe with an example. Let's say your aging parents want to come visit you, but Dad is in a wheelchair. You have several steep steps going into your home. The hallways are not wide enough to accommodate a wheelchair, so your dad would have to sleep in the living room. To use the bathroom, you must help him out of the chair and navigate him inside. Obviously, your home is not equipped for them to visit. Think of this scenario when you want to invite older adults or friends for dinner or host a birthday party. Visitability isn't just an issue for older adults. It also benefits people of all ages with physical disabilities. Imagine how a young child who uses an assistive device must feel when she can't go to a door when out trick-or-treating with friends because of steps or uneven walkways. How sad that a youngster in a wheelchair has to miss his best friend's birthday party because the house is not accessible. Creating a visitable home is easier to do with new construction than remodeling, but in both cases, three basic features must be present. The first is to have a zero-step entrance on an accessible path of travel from the street, sidewalk, or driveway. Second, doorways must provide at least 32 inches clear space throughout the home's main floor, and hallways must provide a minimum of 36 inches of clear width. The third feature is a basic access to a half or preferably full bath on the main floor. A bathroom with basic access means it is long and wide enough for a person using a wheelchair to enter and close the door. An example from my own experience drove home the importance of visitability for me. My mother came to visit me a few times shortly after her head injury. She used a walker, and because I live in a split-level home, getting her in and out of my home took lots of energy. It really wasn't safe. Later, she was in a wheelchair and could not visit me at all because of my stairs. At one point, I considered selling my house to find one that would be visitable, but soon realized there were not many such homes available. When I'm ready to downsize, I plan to either build or buy a home that will have visitability features so I can age in place and my friends can visit. According to research done by the University of Montana's Rural Institute, a quarter of all homes built today will house somebody with a long-term severe mobility impairment. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention conducted an annual behavioral risk factor survey in Montana. One question asked was, if a person who uses special equipment, such as a wheelchair, came to visit you, could they get into your house without being carried up the steps or over other obstacles? Based on the responses, they estimated that less than 20% of Montana homes are visitable. That baseline will be used to measure progress. Currently, visitability is not required by law. Many communities have developed new building codes to put these standards into place. Some start by using the standards for public housing construction, while others also require private homes to be visitable. More features beyond the three mentioned earlier can be utilized when considering building a home to be visitable. However, requiring those three basic ones are a worthy first step. In order to get more visitable homes in the marketplace, we can all be more proactive by educating developers, loan officers, builders, and buyers of the benefits of visitability. If you're interested in learning more, contact the University of Montana Rural Institute or the Montana Housing Task Force, operated by the Montana Centers for Independent Living. I hope everyone will get on board with the idea of visitable homes so we are all able to visit each other as we age in place. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Connor tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.